The fact that the English audience didn't have this form of access to the original text is honestly a failure of the institutions who had all the resources in their hands.
Exactly.
That's an honest word. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hello, dear listeners. This is your old friend, or I hope it's your old friend, Lin, the voice of the Fifth Monkey. Since launching the series in December 2022, we've been slowly building followership across different platforms. And the place where we managed to reach the most people is Spotify. We recently managed to pass the 1,000 follower mark on Spotify, and it's really something worth celebrating. And once again, I would like to remind you that we receive no outside funding. The only way the team can be paid for our work is through your contributions via subscription or Patreon. This is important to the continuation of the series because it is actually impossible for the team to be forever volunteering. And today, in this very special episode, I am sitting down with our dear proofreader, Brooklyn, to talk about her journey with the series and hopefully answer some of the questions from our listeners. So why not just say hi to our listeners and tell us what part of the world you're from?
Hi, listeners. Again, my name is Brooklyn, and I am from California in the United States.
Right. And so I'm Chinese and currently lives in China. Brooklyn and I actually never met in real life. I think this is actually the first time we have a voice chat, right? I don't think we've done voice chats before.
No, it's fun how we can connect like this.
Yeah, exactly. And before we go into how we met and everything, we just want to clarify that not every member of the team wishes to be identified and known. So we definitely think that we should be known for the content of our work rather than who we are personally. So you won't see me sit down with another member anytime soon. And we won't go into too much detail about ourselves. With that being said, Brooklyn and I actually met in a completely different realm on the internet. Right, I was really active in a manga fandom, and you started following me first, and you liked my every Tumblr post, which was impressive because I don't even remember what I posted. You were a very aggressive liker, and that's how I remember your name.
Yeah, I was just really fangirling you hard because of your reviews, and everything was so on point and so detailed and in-depth, and you were really the only person doing that in the English-speaking part of the fandom. Yeah. And so, yeah, that got a huge bit of my love.
Right.
I was like a fangirl before we became friends, so.
Yeah, and then we started talking on Twitter, like, mm-hmm. some years after you started following me, and mm-hmm. we've been mutuals for quite a few years now, I think, and we talk on a daily basis. We won't name which manga this is because that's like a whole nother topic, and that's an abyss of, I don't want to get into that. Yeah. And on the other hand, I got to know our Sanskrit instructor when he was an exchange student at my university. So we met in school and we have known each other for over 10 years now. And I think you were the one of the first people that I talked to, like the first non-Chinese person that I talked to mm-hmm. with regard to starting this project. And I think you just kind of came into the team like naturally. Like there was never an invitation or anything. It was just like, hey, do you want to like proofread the script? And they were like, okay.
I mean, that's the best, isn't it? And you just show up and things turn out.
Yeah, and one of the mm-hmm. things I think that makes you such a natural person for the job is that you just have such broad perspectives about just international culture in general. Like, you're not like stuck in, say, like the Hollywood perspective or like a very like Anglo-Saxon centric view of the world. So when I show you like really like super Chinese stuff, like you kind of get it, and I don't have to kind of explain it
That's
with extra effort. You know, so it's I have confidence in you just kind of picking these things up as we go.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I feel like the script and everything is just safe in your hands. Like, you're not, you wouldn't be asking like really like basic questions about why things are, because you kind of already know, which is just, it's really hard to find someone like that. That's kind of the...
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I'm just really glad that I can like fulfill that role there.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's like my background, because I'm just, California, there's lots of immigrants and lots of Chinese, and I just picked it up kind of just through learning and being around different cultures, I guess. It just came naturally to me.
And I think it takes talent to do that, actually, because I think one of the reasons that makes you so indispensable to the team is that not only you have this perspective, but also the fact that you have never read the original text of Journey to the West. And I think that's actually like important, because I know the story from cover to cover. Like, I can tell the story backwards and again. So there are things that I take for granted that you will point out, you know? Like, this place needs explanation. Which is interesting, because one of the translators that we referenced, because one of them is an American, Anthony Yu, is an American Chinese, and the other is a British scholar named W.J.F. Jenner. W.J.F. Jenner, when he translated Journey to the West, that was also his first time reading the original text. Like, he actually never read the novel in its entirety before he was tasked to translate the story. And I think that's what made his version slightly more readable than Anthony Yu, because Anthony Yu is a religious scholar, so his translation is a bit more wordy in that sense. But W.J.F. Jenner really tried his best to make the story just more easily accessible for native English readers. So that's why your perspective is really important, because you have never read the original text, and you are able to point out to us that places that need clarification and elaboration for first-time listeners. Because otherwise, it would never occur to me that some of the more mundane aspects of the story actually needed further explanation, you know?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what a proofreader's job is. I think not everybody understands what an English proofreader does, and part of that is pointing out areas that need clarification. And, it's not just checking the grammar and, or for spelling errors. It's part of it, my job that I take very seriously is the direction and the meaning of the original text. And so it's understanding the original objective of the story and where it's going to go and just the style of how it's told, and figuring out how to match that and keep the original meaning. And that's pretty much what a translating proofreader does. So you take a text that I haven't read before, I take what the translator gives me, and I try to make sure it fits the linguistic, social, and cultural context of the readership, or our listeners, in our case.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, like given your approach, and even given your understanding of, say, Chinese culture in general, what do you think was the biggest difficulty when it comes to kind of approaching the story and kind of proofread it?
So basically it's just the finding the right words, because I think we came into a couple of issues just recently, and so it's just trying to find those right words where you take the
the right tone, you know, like if there's a hint of sarcasm or are they trying to mock or praise?
There's usually a few sentences where the word order isn't correct, like how it would be said in English, and it can take several read-throughs before I catch everything and or we find solutions to issues that come up, because there's just, you know, localizing it so that it's the English sounds natural and so that you can read it without tripping up yourself up. That, yeah, that's a learned skill, because again, and it's something that not everybody can do. I'm currently in the middle of a master's program learning how to edit and deal with translations, so there's a lot of behind the scenes work, and it's just you either get it or you don't. So
speaking of just having an episode come out, just as a team, we think the translating part is actually the easier side of the issue, because Journey to the West is written in very, very plain, very down-to-earth language. So even modern-day Chinese readers can very easily pick up the story without having to do very laborious research. So getting the chapter down to English is the easier part, you know, and having it proofread and me recording, recording takes time, but I wouldn't call it like the difficult part. It's always the sound editing. I ran about this to Brooklyn like every single time. She knows when I'm sound editing because I sound especially grumpy during those days. I love every part of this project, but like sound editing would have to be my least favorite part of it, because it has to do with my head hating headphones. So, because I always need to put on headphones when I do sound editing, and my head just can't stand that. So the back of my skull would feel stressed after a certain amount of time, and I have to take the headphones off to let my head breathe. So. And also, it's just very frustrating to hear unrelated noises from my reading, because that means I have to record again. But overall, the story itself flows very naturally from my tongue because I know it so well. It's always the technical parts that drives me nuts, because I don't have the best equipment and environment to meet my own standards. So some of you asked how long would it usually takes to make a final cut of an episode. First of all, the translator works in a parallel universe from the rest of us. So the translating part has reached, it's currently at chapter 15, and that's like literally already has nothing to do with what we're doing now. So,
we're currently
working on chapter 8, and translation is at chapter 15. So the translator is always ahead of us, and as for actually turn it into an audio drama, we cut each chapter into two parts to make sure no episode is longer than 30 minutes. For me, it never takes longer than an hour to record one episode, but it usually takes 4 or 5 times that amount of time to do the sound editing. We have to denoise and adjust the lengths of pauses, and if I got anything wrong or didn't feel right about certain places, I would just re-record that particular phrase or sentence. So it's not like I have to do it in one sitting. You know, I can always kind of record again. I definitely struggled more in the first few episodes because I was relatively new to this thing, and I was still in the phase where I haven't got used to my own voice. Like, I think every voice actor needs to go through that phase of just hating their own voices, to just slowly getting more comfortable with that. So in recent months, I feel like the process has become smoother as I find my pace. Do you have the same struggle on your side, just proofreading?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just you have to find your rhythm and get used to the contacts, and then things usually start to flow. You start to pick up on more errors once you understand the style that it needs to be in. Yeah, yeah. So, with your voice, I guess listeners wanted to know what, how do you choose your characters? How, what tone of voice for each one? Do you feel it, or are you more just focused on getting your voice right?
So, in general, yeah, because I don't, I record alone, so there's like no other person instructing me on what is right or not right. So I tend to just flow with the scene, I guess. And I didn't assign specific voices for any character apart from maybe the Monkey King and so far Guan Yin. And also, like, there are still other protagonists that haven't appeared in the story yet. But for the main characters, I definitely have like a voice assigned to them. But for other characters, I just have a general voice for a certain gender or age and would slightly adjust them to suit the characters. For example, like the Dragon Kings, I use their old man voice, like the older man voice for Dragon Kings. And also for the Great White Ghost Star, I use an old man voice, but these are different old man voices because the Dragon Kings are at an obvious disadvantage when they try to confront Wukong, so I make them sound a little bit more timid and taken aback, whereas the Great White Ghost Star sounds more confident or even cunning because he's a skilled diplomat on a mission to convince and trick. So, and also, listeners may only hear my voice from the end product, but the fact is when I record, my arms are all over the place, like they're never still. So, like even right now, I'm like waving my arms. I constantly wave and stretch my arms out when I get to the more intense scenes. I think it helps me to project my voice. The only character whom I have a special gesture for is Guan Yin. When I voice her, my palms immediately fold and kind of like instantly puts me in a state of serenity. So I can talk in the calmer, gentler voice that I assigned her. So when Guan Yin is talking, just imagine me folding my arms in front of the mic, like as if I'm praying, because that's how I get into her character. But for everyone else, my arms are just all over the place. It's a lot of fun.
It
Yeah,
sounds
the
fun.
recording is a lot of fun. It's just the sound editing. So.
Can I ask, so who was your inspiration for voice acting? Are you channeling anyone in particular, or did you have a role model?
I think if our listeners went to check out our YouTube channel, you'll notice that at the bottom of our ending credit page says, "This production is dedicated to the late Mr. Lin Zhaoming, whose voice never fails to bring a smile to our faces." It's at the end of our every video. This is very personal to me, especially because Lin Zhaoming was the legendary actor and voice performer who created the Cantonese audio drama of Journey to the West in the 1980s. I grew up listening to his performance on radio and cassette tapes, and I have the full drama downloaded on all my devices. It's my go-to playlist whenever I have trouble making decisions about what to listen to. You can literally randomly play any episode, and within 5 seconds, I would know exactly which part of the story it is. He passed in 2016, but his performance after all these years is still just as fun and fresh as when I first listened to them as a little girl. In a way, I think the audio drama format is really returning to the true root of the story, because Journey to the West is birthed from street performers and grassroots theater. The fact that the English audience didn't have this form of access to the original text is honestly a failure of the institutions who had all the resources in their hands.
Exactly.
That's an honest word, yeah.
I mean,
Because this story was created by the people and it belongs to the people.
yeah, and you can definitely see that in the text. I mean, when I'm reading it, I can picture theater troops of what the chorus would be, which parts the actors would might call out to an audience, and it has that natural rhythm of a theater piece, almost like Greek theater, where you have the chorus and you have all these different parts and characters with the same type of archetypes in them.
And also you sometimes vaguely feel like they're breaking the fourth wall somehow.
Right,
You know, they're
right.
like making comments about things that, like, if you put it in a real conversation, it feel a little bit out of place, but when you put it on stage, it
Right.
feels more natural, you
Yeah,
know.
yeah.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you really bring that out a lot in your voice acting. Just the dialogue comes to life, and I'm really impressed by how dignified you make the characters sound. Like even when they're angry, it's like a quiet anger, and I think that's a really good choice for this type of audio production. Because with a lot of different voice actors, they might have gone on full on ranting, and it would have like made it hard to listen to, and kind of ruined the dignified undercurrent that this story has.
The quite angry part is probably just me being Chinese, so that's just part about of being a Chinese person. You'll be angry in a quiet manner. And so and I think just Lin Zhaoming is just an inspiration to all of us, because he also hand wrote his own script. That was before the age of computers, which was why he could, like, the story flows naturally from his tongue, because he knew what he had to say. And that's why we decided to produce an original translation rather than reading someone else's. We believe that we need to fully immerse ourselves in the process in order to come up with the best delivery. So, and also a story about Lin Zhaoming, and because in all his years performing on stage and with his voice, he earned countless awards, you know. And but he said one of his proudest moments, surpassing any award, was when a group of blind listeners wrote to him and telling him that we cannot see with our eyes and are living rather drab lives, but when we listen to you telling stories, we are filled with joy. Thank you for bringing joy to our lives. Bringing joy to the people was what he considered his greatest accomplishment in life, and this is why accessibility is always on the top of our minds. So we want to make sure that, you know, people who can't see or have trouble reading would have the audio version, and, you know, people who have trouble listening would always have subtitles, you know.
Yeah, that's great.
So yeah, and I also get asked if there's like a general image for the characters when I read them. In my brain, there's definitely like heavy influence from, say, TV drama or picture books from when I was a kid. So the general image of these characters are usually a mixture of those adaptations. Some of these characterizations deviate from the original text, but it's actually kind of hard to replace childhood memory, so they kind of just get stuck there. But I feel like new readers should be able to kind of pick up their characterization from the original text without these pre-existing influences. And I think that's probably how it works for you. Right, like you, when you read them, this is the first time you knew about these characters.
Yeah, it's or generally I mean I grew up with the story in children's books as well, but it was just fragments of the story. And so yeah, and for me I kind of have like a little visual animation that goes on in my mind, and it like it's very basic because I actually have a form of aphantasia, which means I have no visual images in my mind. They're just kind of phantom images of movement and pictures, faint pictures. And so it's, I rely a lot on the motion of the words to tell what's going on.
So, what do you think surprised you or impressed you the most about the original text compared to what you previous know about. So, like, what are these, like, secondhand resources and influence? Like,
to be honest, the length of the text, because you know, I thought it would be just kind of folktale length, you know, and I wasn't really prepared for this huge epic. I mean, I usually don't read epics. Mm-hmm. Because there is a lot of things going on, and a lot of the time it relies on all that visual information that I can't keep track of. Anyway, I mean, I couldn't read Lord of the Rings for that reason, but this is why I really I do like this version, because it cuts out a lot of that redundant info and things that would make it really hard for someone to follow or lose interest, and just focuses on the story and the symbolism and the meanings. And so it makes it a much richer read for me, because I'm getting all that raw information without all the confusion going on.
Right. Well, it's interesting, right? Because even when I read it in Chinese, mm-hmm. I also, like, visually skip the mm-hmm. long poems just, like, describing
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
I don't even read that word to word, so, you know, mm-hmm. so, which is why we made the decision to, like, not include those in the translation either, because that would just distract the listeners.
Yeah. Well, yeah, even being a poet, sometimes that can detract from the meaning, because, like you said, our goal is accessibility, mm-hmm. and if it takes away from the original meaning from the text and the story, then yeah, it does have to go, even though as a poet you kind of die a little side, like, oh, this is beautiful imagery, and but it's not adding anything.
Mm.
It's not requisite to understanding what is going on and what the true meaning of the text is.
Yeah.
So
what do you think would be the biggest impact, like, this audio drama would have on listeners who have formerly no direct contact with the original text, like if they've only mm-hmm. like watched cartoons or like read manga or something?
Oh, I definitely think it could be the start of a literary and cultural adventure for them. Like we mentioned before, it definitely clears away a lot of the barriers that English people in English-speaking countries have when accessing Chinese mythology, because there aren't a lot of translated texts available to us. And I kind of have the impression that a lot of people may not even know that China has a mythology outside of dragons, really. So this really opens up, like, a new avenue for people.
Yeah. And also the fact that, you know, because of a lot of historical reasons, we were never, like, a huge mm-hmm. exporter of our own culture. So there's a lot right. of, like, secondhand exportation mm-hmm. from, like, say, Korea, Japan. Like, nothing wrong with that. It's just that you're not getting yeah. it from the people who created it and the people who have to live right. among those mythologies, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely, like, clears away a lot of the misconceptions. And, I mean, it's refreshing to get that original text and to know where the stories came from, and to finally get the big picture, like the full picture of what the stories actually mean to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from what we have released so far, what would be your favorite part or scene of the story?
Just anytime Wukong says nope. That's basic.
Just say no to everything.
Yeah. Nope, nope, nope.
Yeah. I think that's really the kind of childish wonder you see in his character, because he doesn't pretend, you know, like he
mm-hmm.
he's always just yeah. very blunt with his feelings and desires. So I also really like not only about Wukong, I just really like all the scenes that just feature intense verbal insult. Like just people yelling at each other. I love those scenes because that's also the places where the characters in Journey to the West tend to spout really philosophical stuff. It's like at their most angry mm-hmm. and worked up state. So yeah, you don't like when people are talking calmly, like when monks are like conversing in a very calmly manner, there's nothing goes into your brain. You just kind of like, okay, I'm just gonna get the scene done with. But when characters like when animals are just shouting at each other, just insulting each other in almost like an equivalent of racial slurs, just throwing at different species, that's like my favorite part of the entire story, honestly. Yeah. So what do you think, like what impressed you the most about, like, say, just like a general state of Chinese mythology, like from what you know, what you have read so far in Journey to the West, like what is your biggest impression about the Chinese mythological system in general?
I think it's just how grand it actually is and how organized compared to a lot of other mythologies that I've studied. There's a lot more like,
it's more like a lot more branched out.
It's branched out, it's and detailed.
And very strict hierarchy, and like you have different departments, you have like just different gods in charge of all these tasks.
Yeah. Right, everything is, I feel like everything is laid down to the utmost detail, and nobody makes a move without anybody else knowing. And in that hierarchy, it's just, you kind of, you expect the, it's different because you expect, like, the gods to be enlightened and have patience and compassion. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, no, you screw up, you're gone. You're torn into shreds, swords, lightning.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, that's why Chinese people don't really respect our gods. No, that's one of the... I think that's one of the reasons why it's very easy for, say, like contemporary writers or for TV or for books or anything, for them to kind of just insert new gods into that system because it's just such a vast landscape that there are a few gods that kind of just have to be there to make the thing work, but the rest of it is just very fluid, you know, like fluidity of this universe is honestly what I love the most about the Chinese mythological system, because there are no forever immortals and there are no forever mortals, because the reason why these gods act the way they are is because they weren't born as gods. Like, they all have their, you know, folklore origin stories about how they were just a mortal man who just worked really hard to become enlightened, to become an immortal. But no, like, there's no state of being that is constant. Like, the mobility of the soul and the relative fairness of transmigration is kind of what I loved about the system, because when you die, your soul still ends up somewhere. Like, you can still find it if you have the power. So it's not like, just, it does not just vaporize and just be gone. Mm-hmm. But even when you're a god, like just certified god, if you break rules, you will still be banished to like lower hierarchies. You may become a monster, or you may just go back to becoming immortal and you have to like start over again. So there's no almighty power there working the rules of the world. Like, everyone is just part of the system and we have to abide by the rules regardless whether you're a god or a human.
Yeah, that's really unique. You don't see that often. There's usually just some god that where there's no rules that apply, and that's not the case in Chinese mythology. Yeah. Also, the aspect of cultivation is really unique too. The concept that you can just grow your power, like you're a plant or something.
Yeah. Just takes a lot of years, but eventually you can get somewhere as you like try it, if you try hard enough. So, yeah. And
yeah. Or do enough deeds or something.
Yeah, exactly. One of the listeners asked a very important question about Wukong personally. So, why
didn't
the patriarch try and teach the monkey some manners before teaching him all these powerful skills? And I know you have a lot of things to say about that, so why don't you just go ahead?
Okay, so it's kind of a two or three part answer. So for me, Wukong on a symbolic level, he represents like true autonomy and freedom, and he reminds people that, you know, all the hierarchy and everything that we just talked about is kind of ridiculous. There on some level when you're applying it without you know, the context of who a person is, and without understanding that on some level everybody is equal. And like we mentioned before, these gods, they don't possess any chill or compassion, and they're kind of petty,
right.
And they're getting mad at Wukong for being a monkey. And again, it's kind of a dumbass move to set up Wukong, you know, to watch a peach tree. You know, he's going to eat it. That's just what he's going to do. Yeah. And so, you know, they're getting mad at him for making friends and treating people with common respect, you know, the type of respect that is, I will respect you as an equal being, not the kind that says treat me as a superior or else. And so Wukong, he really is treating people with respect. It's, you know, the common courtesy, and that's just part of his personality archetype, really. And so in the second part of my answer would be that, you know, at the time Wukong was training with the patriarch, he just wasn't ready to be taught all that formality there. It's just consistent with Taoism and traditional Chinese teaching methods to teach to a student's strength. If the patriarch had told Wukong about his flaws, that would have caused resistance and prevented him from the self-discovery and self-mastery of his flaws that he later needed to do. Yeah, it's just really important to know that, you know, the patriarch, he knew what kind of demands that he could place on Wukong without it becoming a point of resistance and not exceeding his capabilities. And that's just, you know, letting him adapt his style of fighting and teaching him how to master his techniques in his own manner. That really is what helped him gain the confidence that he does have, so that he could go up to heaven and face all these ridiculous gods.
Yeah, I think it's just really it's a really loving gesture from the patriarch to kind of like to see Wukong just couldn't keep still in class and be like, I'm gonna give you one-on-one lessons because I know you're special, and I wouldn't force you to learn like every other person out there, you know. To that really follows the Confucius belief that you have to to approach a student, like to teach him in a way that suits him, that suits this student particularly, instead of just trying to like kind of like have a, like a general approach for everyone as if, you know, they're the same.
Yeah, or for something, just because that's the tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, so like once listeners get to the later parts of the story, you will realize that Wukong absolutely knows what good manners are, you know? Like he knows everything that he needs to do, but he just, it's just that it's a matter of him refusing to perform these good manners in front of people that just he considered unworthy, you know? And the friendships he built in the Heavenly Palace are absolutely genuine. Like, you will see that when, mm-hmm. when he actually goes on the journey, he constantly needs to call help from, you know, his friends from heaven. And they are all very happy to help because you know that, you know, they had a good time with the monkey when he was up there. So they are happy to give him a hand. So he, Wukong saved his good manners for those who actually treat him as equals and respect him for who he is. So,
right. Yeah, I mean, because the other people there that he didn't get along with, they just set him up for failure all the time and didn't respect him. So.
Yeah, so like, especially for him to you know, to get the title Bi Ma Wen, which is honestly like equivalent of a racial slur when you use it mm-hmm. on a monkey. Like, for what reason do you think he has to, like, return these people with good manners, so to speak? You
right.
know, there's absolutely no reason for him to do that. If that, and that's honestly like he, the anger kind of stayed with him even after he kind of paid the price for what he did. You know, even if he's not like getting back at the gods, like the name still hurts him. So mm-hmm. even if he no longer fights with the gods, the damage of this name stayed with him throughout the novel, as listeners will see. So yeah. And but getting back to what you just mentioned about how this is like a really like a larger epic than you previously thought, is that the mm-hmm. the title of the novel is Journey to the West, but we're like not on the journey yet. So we're like
right.
we won't be on the journey until like chapter 12 or 13, which is like still a few months away. So just keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. And Wukong will be absent for a few chapters. And
yeah, we're on the journey to the east now.
The journey. So. We're at kind of like, we're slowly moving into the least known parts of Journey to West, because it skipped in a lot of the adaptations, and just a lot of people just don't consider it, like don't know that this is an official part of the Journey to the West story. But that's where we are moving into, and we hope we don't lose any listeners in this process, because I know when Wukong is gone, I also feel like something is missing, but he's just going to be officially gone for a few chapters before he mm-hmm. returns for the actual journey. So the journey won't start until a few chapters later, but this, the part we're moving to soon, it's also very, I consider very interesting and important part of the story. So, yeah. Do you have anything else that you want to tell our listeners, or anything to add to the conversation?
I think we covered everything here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I think this is a good place to wrap up the episode. Thank you for joining me in this crosstalk. And once again, we would like to thank our patrons for submitting these very interesting questions. I hope we got you covered. If you also like to directly interact with us or gain priority access, please consider becoming a subscriber or patron. For a few dollars every month, you will be able to listen to the latest episode and access other exclusive content, which we will definitely be making in the future. The team's survival depends on it. This is the Fifth Monkey, and thank you for listening. Journey to the West, an audio drama series, is a production by The Fifth Monkey. If you enjoy our work, Become our paid subscriber or patron to gain access to the latest release and other exclusive content. Head to www.thefifthmonkey.com for links to all the platforms we're on and support us on social media. Shares, comments, emails, all are welcome. This is Lynn. See you in the next episode.